Okay, I wanted to give you that background so you had a sense as to what was actually going on in the Soviet Union. And so bottom line, if you had to capture what was going on from the end of the Second World War until this breakup of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union developed nuclear capabilities that were on par with ours in the United States. So after my first visit over there, which I'll tell you about in a minute, I basically came back and said, look, they know every bit as much about nuclear weapons as we do in the United States. And so that's what they did. And of course, not only the nuclear program, but also the rocket program. So they had enormous capabilities, rockets and missiles, and also on the nuclear front. So what I'm going to focus on here in this middle module is mostly what's captured in the book that we published. Los Alamos Historical Society actually published a book about a year ago. There are two of these volumes, 1,000 pages. I worked on it for about 6 years to try to get the Russians and the Americans, scientists and engineers, who participated in the cooperation part of non-LUGA cooperative threat reduction program. And we wanted to tell the story of what we, the scientists and engineers, did to deal with this changed world. And so we did manage to capture that. And the reason it's 1,000 pages is there are actually like 30, 35 Russian articles in there. And the Russians tell what happened in their own voices, not in ours, not as interpreted by us. And by the way, to get it from Russian language to American to English and have that be readable, as Anna knows, is really a difficult chore. Because the Russians, I always like to say, they speak and write elliptically, never direct with you, because you always want to make sure you leave some ambiguity. So they sort of come around elliptically. And, you know, the Americans are used to dealing directly, so trying to get that elliptical language into stuff we can actually understand took a little doing, but we did it. Okay, so you saw that, Soviet Union collapse. Non-LUGA, what did non-LUGA mean? And what did they see? And what was this idea of nuclear fission? Well, actually, The Dead Hand by David Hoffman, who's been with the Washington Post for many years, and that book won a Pulitzer Prize, where he talks about the end of the Soviet Union. What he said, non-LUGA, they helped Russia and other former Soviet republics cope with an inheritance from hell. So in other words, the nuclear program from the United States angle was seen as inheritance from hell. I mean, everything was bad. Everything was bad. So the idea was, if the US government is going to work with them, how do we make sure we eliminate or prevent? That was the focus of the American intervention. What were the issues? Well, those are my terms. You've heard the loose nukes. So loose nukes means nuclear weapons, control of those weapons. But then loose nuclear materials. You know, I just told you yesterday, plutonium, highly enriched uranium. How about loose people? That's where the knowledge, that's where the experts were. And then loose exports. Would they sell everything that's not nailed down? Those were the four nuclear dangers as the Soviet Union broke up into these 15 separate states. So the immediate issues, and again, Ambassador Medlock referred to that yesterday, I won't spend a lot of time, but the US government did jump into this. And even though George H.W. Bush and his administration took some of the key steps, there were still people in that administration that were reluctant to do much with the Russians. And so it was off to a pretty slow start. President Clinton came in, and then particularly when Secretary Bill Perry came in, first as Deputy Secretary and then as Secretary of Defense. So the most immediate thing was, by this time, the nuclear weapons had been brought back in just four of the republics, namely Russia, Kazakhstan, Belarus, and Ukraine. And for example, Ukraine at that point had the third largest nuclear arsenal in the world. And so that was a concern. And the non-LUGA threat reduction program, and particularly Bill Perry, Ash Carter, but many others, they helped to work with those countries to bring the weapons back to Russia, and then eventually to dismantle those weapons. So that was absolutely key to do it in that time frame. From what I understand, the last weapons came back like by 1996. In addition, one of the other governmental programs, there were about 600 kilograms of highly enriched uranium in Uskhaminogorsk, which is out in Kazakhstan. Through quite a courageous program, people like Andy Weber from the Department of Defense and a number of others managed to convince the Kazakhs to actually sell us more or less that 600 kilograms. And that was brought back and actually taken to Oak Ridge site. So that was called Project Sapphire. That was government, mostly government. Another one I just already mentioned to you, the megatons to megawatts. 500 metric tons of highly enriched uranium downblended to reactor fuel sold to the United States. Done an idea by Tom Neff, who at that time was research scientist at MIT. That was done over 20 years' time and concluded successfully, even though there were lots of ups and downs in this particular program. So it wasn't a simple shot, but nevertheless, it was done and it's important. But then we go to the labs, and I already provided you this background. We got together at the Joint Verification Experiment. And then here is part of what runs through the thread of the book, actually, because these are words that are said by David Holloway, who's my colleague at Stanford, and he wrote this book on Stalin and the bomb. And he said, as you can see, nuclear history is not the history, is the history not only of weapons, but also of societies and individual destinies. And we heard that yesterday also from Ambassador Matlock. And it's also important that nuclear history has that human dimension, and that human dimension comes through in the entire association of the nuclear scientists from the two sides. And in fact, you know, one of the interesting aspects of that, the guy who led the Soviet delegation to the JVE was one Viktor Mikhailov, Viktor Nikitovich. He later wrote this book called I'm a Hawk. And many in the US government considered him to be just about impossible to deal with. He really was a hawk. Turns out he was a card-carrying scientist, actually an academician, Soviet Academy of Scientist. And he was their leader. I met him, I sat with him in the control room, and he said afterwards, as quoted in the New York Times, I always dreamed of seeing how the US experts work. And as you can read, he said, very friendly, very warm people. But then the most important part of what he said was, we have cut a window into their hearts as well. So this is 1988, after, you know, a few months of working together at this test site, nuclear weapons scientists working together, trying to make these measurements. And he realized that they had cut a window into our hearts. And that worked both ways. We were, our folks were out at Semipalatinsk. Then what Mikhailov did, he was the head of the technical delegation also at the Geneva talks to finish up the negotiations for the Threshold Test Ban Treaty. And as our experts were out in Moscow or the other places, lo and behold, Mikhailov invited them to come to their nuclear weapons labs. Two cities of Sarov, I've already mentioned, Snezhinsk is the equivalent there, Livermore. These cities were not on Soviet maps. That's how secret they were. They were not on Soviet maps. And he invites them in August 1990 and October 1990. And so that was the first weapon scientist. My colleagues from Los Alamos and Livermore are there around bonfires and in the tents with the Russians. And what was amazing, already by this time in 1990, they had put together in Vinyev, which is their Los Alamos, the Institute for Experimental Physics, they had put together a brochure. Now remember, this is still Soviet Union, Gorbachev time. This is what they said in conclusion in this brochure. We express hope that Vinyev is well presented as a reliable supplier of scientific and engineering products. And by that, they don't mean selling, you know, to cause nuclear proliferation. They mean cooperating scientifically. They're ready to cooperate on a contractual basis to work with us, to create joint ventures. Again, this is 1990. So what happened here is when my colleagues came back from these visits, and they came and they said, "Sig, these guys want to work together. And they've opened up an avenue where you should go over to Russia and you should visit those labs." So I go to Washington, I try to convince them that, hey, we had feelers from the Russian side, they're ready to talk. Why don't you let us go? Well, it turns out it wasn't that simple. And basically our government wasn't ready for doing that. So from essentially October 1990 until December of 1991, I could not convince Washington to allow a lab directors exchange. But then after the events of August 1991, the Nanluga program first coming on, I remember specifically we had a meeting with Admiral James Watkins, who was Secretary of Energy. He was out in Leesburg, Virginia, December 16th, 1991. And he had just come from a cabinet meeting, and President George H.W. Bush said, "These guys, they're coming apart. The Soviet Union is going to come apart. And I'm concerned about the brain drain, which is the loose people part." So Watkins meets with us, the lab directors, and he says, "So what can we do to avoid the brain drain? And I said, "Admiral Watkins, I've been trying to convince your people for the last 18 months we ought to go over there. Since I run Los Alamos, I know what I'd want to do to keep my people at home. So why don't we go ask them?" He said, "Why don't you?" By Christmas, this was December 6th, I said, "No, I don't want to go that badly. It's pretty cold in Russia." In February, less than 2 months after that, their lab directors, we had set all this up, their lab directors came over, visited Livermore, visited Los Alamos. Here I am in the typical photo in Los Alamos. Here's at one of the laser facilities at Livermore. And 2 weeks later, we were in Sarov, and here I am shaking hands with Yuli Hariton, who I already told you a little bit about. And this is Sarov, 23rd. Of February. I was going to show you a video. They actually took a video of this arrival, but I had major PowerPoint problems on Sunday as I was finishing putting all of this together. My PowerPoint crashed, and the video that I have is like 200 megabytes. And so I said, okay, I'm not going to try to put this in. I managed to recover it, but so all you do is you see this. But the part of the video that I really like is this guy, Alexander Pavlovsky, who is an academician, absolutely fantastic scientist. As I get off the plane, since he had been to Los Alamos separately visiting, so we knew each other, I get off the plane and he gives me this huge Russian bear hug. Okay, now these are weapons guys from each other's sides, first visit. And so when I show this at Livermore Laboratory, I show him the video, he gives me a bear hug, and I said, I've been out here at Livermore dozens and dozens of times. I've never been greeted with a bear hug. So for those of you, that during the Cold War, the Soviet Union, to Los Alamos, the way we viewed it, Soviet Union was our adversary. The enemy was Livermore. And you have to understand some of the makings up as to how Livermore was formed. It was formed, as I told you, sort of to be in opposition to Los Alamos. We've kept that spirit of cooperation ever since, and it turns out their two laboratories have exactly the same relationship with each other. You could almost say they hate each other. They don't really hate each other, but they're incredibly competitive with each other. Okay, so here we are. So let's put some numbers on this. So what are the loose problems? Tens of thousands. The best number we can put on the Soviet nukes is near the end of Soviet Union, like 39,000. You saw the curve. 39,000 nuclear weapons. Okay, we had 25,000, and as I said, that was also plenty. Fissile materials. plutonium and highly enriched uranium. I showed you yesterday, this problem child, North Korea, 20 to 40 kilograms of plutonium, maybe a couple of hundred or so kilograms of highly enriched, kilograms, 1.4 million kilograms. Can you imagine? Now, the U.S. had, you know, maybe we had close to a million kilograms also. We had plenty. Just totally, those numbers are just mind-boggling today. People, several hundred thousand who worked in their nuclear complex, all together, including their civilian nuclear complex, Viktor Mikhailov, who later became their Minister of Atomic Energy, said they had a million people working in the nuclear complex. And exports, you know, huge, huge complex, and the economy was in chaos. So what's important to understand, and Nolan Lugar understood this, and the NGO community understood this. It took us a little while, but I think we got there. The threat changed from nukes being in the hands of the governments, in other words, them annihilating us, to making sure that they don't get out of the hands of the government. So all of a sudden, it was to our advantage to make sure they can take care of all of these. And it isn't going to happen by just eliminating and preventing. And that's where I'm going to show you where we came in. So in this visit over there, it was just, it was mind-boggling visits to go into those two places, you know, their Los Alamos and their Livermore. I was told, even though we were allowed to go, John Knuckles, who was director at Livermore at that time, came along with me, and we each had two of our scientists along. There were people in the National Security Council who were not happy with this, you know, to send these boy scientists over, and they were boy scientists, you know, send them over to work these diplomatic issues with the Russians. And they finally, they sort of gave in and said, okay, you know, Admiral Watkins said we should go. He's got President Bush's backing, but don't sign anything. You know, you guys go over there, don't sign anything. Well, we got there, we got out of Sarov, okay, didn't sign anything. We got to Snezhinsk, to their Livermore. We're there in the offices of Boris Litvinov, who was their chief engineer, under the portraits of Khrushchev and Lenin. Khrushchev was the overall head of their nuclear program. The Russians said, you've got to sign something. I mean, you can't leave, as those of you, you can't leave without signing something. So we say, okay, a protocol. So we'll sign a protocol. And we still have copies of this protocol. And this is what we came, you know, we spent a couple of hours and we thrashed out this list. And if you look at, this was 1992, worried about the safety and security of nuclear weapons in transport, because they said, we've got all these weapons coming back. You know, we know how to take care. We've done this before, but not this many so fast. How do we prevent the proliferation of knowledge? Nuclear proliferation to other countries and nuclear terrorism. We talk about nuclear terrorism. This is 1991. It's not post 9/11. Emergency response. What do we do if something happens? Safety of nuclear weapons that remain in the stockpile, not only the ones being brought back. And then they told us about the environmental disasters they had out, particularly in the Urals and Kyshtym. There was a 57 explosion of nuclear waste dump. And they said, we've got problems. We'd like to work together on those. So we came back with this protocol. Oops. Well, what I was told, and we put it in the book, is I went back to see Watkins with this, and he said, oh, no, you can't do all this. He said, the best we're going to allow is you can do fundamental science with them. And we said, okay, we're off and running. But when this thing got to the National Security Council, we were told somebody took it, crumpled it up, threw it in the waste paper basket, and said, this document does not exist. There is no document like this. Because we were just, I mean, it sounds ridiculous now, but this was so far out ahead of what was just happening. Soviet Union just came apart, right? They were our adversary for decades. And here you get the scientists getting together, and they said, hey, look, why don't we work on these things together? But we did. And just to show you how the world can change is by 1993 then, we celebrate the 50th anniversary of the Los Alamos Laboratory. when Los Alamos was set up, April 43. This was April 93. So, and I was director, as the young guy on the left side. And we not only invited the Brits, the French, and of course all the Washington dignitaries, we invited the Russians. And academician Evgeny Vrorin is there, and he presents me. The Russians brought gifts. In this case, you can't really see it, but right here is a memento. It's a piece of serpentine. That's a mineral that's very common in the Urals. And on top of it is like a miniature version of a warhead. And it's actually made from pieces of an SS-11 missile that was pointed at the United States. So he brought that to me as a, this is 1993. He brought it, gave it to me. But then the most mind-boggling part, on the side of the serpentine, it had a little brass plaque. And on the brass plaque, they inscribed this: "From Russia with love." This was not that long after the James Bond movie. So, and Yuri Trutnev, the academician from Sarov, he brought me this beautiful big medallion, a bronze medallion. On one side of it, and it was on a swivel, on one side was a bust of Yuli Harittov. On the other side was a bust of J. Robert Oppenheimer. So they had it front and back like that. So that's when I knew the Cold War was over. A lot of people have different views of their Cold War. This one was there. So let me now go through and say, so what I hope I've convinced you so far, these guys were ready to work. They knew the world had changed and they were pushing us rather than vice versa. You know, we were still, we were interested, you know, we were curious, we were interested, but they were pushing us. They had these proposals. They wanted to sign the protocol. So they were pushing us. So the question is, why? Why? And I'm going to show these photos later. Oh, by the way, when we were there for that visit, this is John Knuckles, and here's myself, to one of their laser labs. I still have a little journal. They actually gave it to me. It says Lanl Livermore, and then Vinyev and Nitiev in front. And I took notes during my whole visit. And I went back when I did the book at those notes. It's remarkable what they told us. I mean, not secrets, but just, you know, what science they did, what really energized them, and what capabilities they had. These guys were really, really good. Okay, so why? On the US side, the loose problems. I was concerned myself, you know, particularly about the loose materials. The loose nukes, I thought they could control. The loose materials, I had major concerns. And curiosity, you know, what's the other side really like? And then Russia, end of isolation. Yeah, I told you, Harittov was there in Cambridge, 1926 to 28. Their scientists were in the great school of European physics, just like our scientists were. And then, end of World War, Cold War, isolation. Scientists don't like to be isolated. They wanted to pay their people because the economy literally went to hell. And so they couldn't pay their people. So they were looking, you know, to work with us. And then they wanted to mitigate the nuclear dangers, concerns about the weapon safety, the storage, and then hope. So what we were told, working with you gives our scientists hope that there is some future, because they felt completely deserted, actually, by Gorbachev, you know, which is interesting. So Gorbachev is not a hero, either in these places or for a good part of Russia. And then they had a sense of global responsibility. So that was there. And then most importantly, since we were scientists and engineers, to discover, to create, and to build something together. I mean, their heart was in new discoveries. Can we work together? You guys know certain things, we know certain things. If we get that together, can't we do even better? You know, scientists like to create new knowledge. Engineers are easier. Just give them something to build. You know, they love to build things. And we did both of those together. Okay, so to run through some of these then. So how, the lab-to-lab part. Scientists, engineers working together. One of the most important things was we put boots on the ground almost immediately. You know, within 6 months, we were setting up experiments inside of their fence in Biniev. And when you put boots on the ground, guess what? You learn something. So what we learned, how did they view the David Hoffman equivalent? Was this an inheritance from hell? Heavens no. They thought it was the crowning achievement of the Soviet system. Nuclear, they were among the best in the world. So nuclear weapons, they were their guarantor of their sovereignty. The materials, they viewed this as the economic resource. So today, 1.4 million, that's fantastic. That's gonna power nuclear energy, you know, for the rest, not only of our lives, but our children and grandchildren. Because you can feed plutonium into a reactor. You can take the HEU, as I told you, and feed it into a reactor. The nuclear scientists and engineers, were they concerned about drain brain? They said, no, these guys are the engine of what's going to build our economic recovery and the exports. They said, rather than just oil and gas, this is high-tech export. We want to be able to export civilian nuclear energy. And unless you understood this, you could not really build an appropriate cooperative program with the Russians that both satisfies what they need and satisfies what we need. So that's what we tried to bring to the table. And early on, it was immensely successful. We managed to work quite well with our government, but became more difficult. So again, as I just told you, cooperate to do good, not just to prevent the bad. Quick, flexible, concrete results. Concrete, you know, they would say. You guys just come to the government. They said, you just come and talk. All you Americans want to do is talk. We want to do things. So we did. So we went. We did the experiments. And we were flexible. We were quick. So what did we do? We didn't just sit around a conference table. This is one of the experiments we did together. And you can't tell the Russians, well, you can tell the Russians. This is obviously, this is an American, this is an American, that's a Russian, that's an American. But it's hard to tell them apart. Our scientists work hand in glove together. One of the things the Russians were best at, not just building bombs, but because they were good at building bombs, they knew how to use explosives better than anybody in the whole wild world. And Russians love to blow things up. I mean, they just love to blow things up. We would do these kind of experiments in the laboratory. They do it out in the field. And this is a fantastic experiment. Actually, it's one that goes back to Sakharov days. So what we wanted to do was to create very high magnetic fields. And it turns out you can create a magnetic field, you know, with appropriate electric currents. You create a magnetic field. And then if you really want to make that high, you squeeze it. And what better to squeeze it like a bomb? In this case, a cylinder instead of a sphere, and you squeeze that magnetic field. Eventually, we wound up creating the highest magnetic fields ever created on Earth. I'll show you that in a minute. But that's what we did. And so our guys were there for weeks at a time. And one of the neat compliments to this, since many of you are students of Russian culture and history and so forth, is my colleague Alla Kasyanova, expatriate Russian, is working with me on an electronic archive addition to this. And so we actually have a website at Los Alamos, L2L, like lab to lab, at stanford.edu. On that website, we present a lot of other information. We've interviewed a lot of people who were there to provide their input. And then this guy right here, Brody Anderson. So Brody Anderson was a technician from Cajun country, and he wound up at Los Alamos. And what he did while he was there for 6-7 weeks at a time, setting up these experiments, he wrote poems. He wrote poems. And it turns out he wrote poems for the English club in Sarov. And he went there, he read them, handwritten, and he left it to them. And we didn't have any record of those poems until one of our guys was over there. He got the poems from the Russian Club. We've typed them up and we've put them on this website. And they will just, I mean, they'll bring tears to your eyes. It's just unbelievable. And then one of the other physicists wrote a poem that he called The Walking Stick, because the walking stick is so important in Russian history when you leave. He called it the walking stick. And it's just, it's really amazing. So they developed the camaraderie to work together, to do things that had never been done scientifically. And after one of those, what I just told you, this mega tons, in this case, to mega Gauss. Gauss is a measure of magnetic field. So the Earth's magnetic field is somewhere between 2/10 and 6/10 of a Gauss, depending on where you are. We created 28 megatons. So we talk about this megatons to mega Gauss, which was the Tom Neff program, incredibly important. The Russians thought, well, you know, that was okay, but there was no science in that stuff. I mean, you just took it, you downgraded it, you feed it in a reactor. What's so exciting about that? I mean, it's good, a lot of money, it's good, it gets rid of the material. This is what they wanted. This, they created new science, the world's largest magnetic field ever. And Sasha Bikov on the left picks up Steve Younger, who I had sent there and was head of our Russian programs for a while. And he just lifts him off the ground, and you look at those faces. That speaks for the human dimension. By the way, Steve Younger just became director of Sandia National Laboratory. Okay, partnership was really important. Side by side, step by step. This wasn't Americans just giving them financial assistance to help those poor Russian suckers, you know, to be able to get over this dissolution of the Soviet Union. We felt they were our equals. They were as good as we were. Instead of just trust but verify, you know, trust but benefit from that. Get something out of the trust. Continuity of effort. It might sound a little hypocritical, but you know, presidents come and go. Guys like me sort of stick around forever. You know, I've been doing this since 1988. From one presidential administration to another. People like Bill Potter has been doing this for all this time. There was a continuity regardless of administrations. People like myself and my colleagues were there, and the same on the Russian side. And also, so we were catalysts to some of the government efforts, and we took an approach, whereas the government programs, you know, and there were at least a dozen of these nuclear programs that were government-sponsored, because over the years, the Nanluga program spent something like $12 billion. You know, it did put American money to work the Russian programs. But the American programs were stovepiped, you know, plutonium disposition in this stovepipe, HEU, LEU in this stovepipe, you know, some nuclear cities to fight the brain drain in this stovepipe. We at the labs, we had to worry about the whole thing. And so that brought, and then window of opportunity. I mean, this was special time. If you think back now that in less than 2 months after the dissolution of the Soviet Union, John Knuckles and I were over there and they were over here. And one of the reasons, and why a window of opportunity, I worked not for the US government, but for the University of California, because University of California ran Los Alamos and Lawrence Livermore laboratories. And my boss, David Gardner, president of the university at that time, when I told him I'm going to go to Russia, you know, in today's world, you tell that to one of the corporate entities that runs the lab, they say, you're going to do what? And he said, you go do what's best for the country. Don't worry about us. And so that's why we went. So we had this window of opportunity. The running of the labs has changed dramatically in these last couple of decades, and not for the better. Okay, so then Loose Nukes specifically, what was done? The first program was what was called Safe and Secure Dismantlement. And that is essentially dismantlement on their part as the weapons come back, help them to make sure they get safely and securely to be dismantled. And then we also had a program that was actually called Warhead Safety and Security Exchange to work with the Russians. What was done in the Safe and Secure Dismantlement, for example, the Sandia National Laboratory that does more of the engineering things associated with nuclear weapons, they provided Kevlar blankets. for the Russian nuclear weapons, that in case somebody goes and shoots bullets at these and is able to actually breach a nuclear warhead, that it doesn't blow up in a mushroom cloud. So Kevlar blankets. Working on the transportation, on the rail transportation systems. You know, the way that they protected their rail transportation is by putting nothing on the trains. They say, we'll just move them without anybody knowing what's there. We didn't think that was good enough. We worked together on those things. And then most remarkably, President Clinton in 1996, as I indicate here, he signed his PDD 47, and that's worthwhile for you who have an interest in Russia and what happened in the nuclear arena to look up. It's now declassified. And what he said is essentially, he gave the justification of why we were interested in working directly with the Russians. And what's amazing, he said, greater transparency and the safe and secure maintenance and drawdown of Russian and U.S. arsenal. And he actually even left open the possibility that someday we might exchange classified information, because all of our work was no exchange of secret information. But it helped to provide for us, the people at the laboratories, the underpinnings to actually look at some of these very, very sensitive aspects. You know, for example, to actually model and test the system for advanced security to work with the Russians, whether it was for their rail cars, you know, for their storage magazines, and so forth. And then also, this is one of the cutest stories. In one of the workshops that we had with the Russians were saying, look, we're having literally a devil of a time getting the components apart after they've been in the system for a while. So they're aged components, we get them out, and we're having trouble disassembling them. And they were using mechanical methods. And Jerry Dow from Livermore, as they had this workshop, said, oh my goodness, he says, you know, we just use a solvent. And this is a common industrial solvent, DMSO, you know, dimethyl sulfoxide. And the Russians said, you've just given us a great gift. And it turns out, so exchanging things like, we didn't have to know what their nuclear weapons actually look like, but doing those for safer disassembly. Okay, loose nuclear materials. This was particularly my personal interest, because when I went there, both to Sarov and to Snezhinsk, and I saw how they protected their nuclear materials, it was not gonna work in the world that they had now changed to. They used what I used to call guns, guards, and gulags, you know, or what I also call the system of grave consequences. You don't dare try to walk out with any nuclear materials. So that system, the Soviet system, and it worked, by the way. You know, we have indication that some of our materials may have leaked out of the United States during the Cold War. As far as we know, they had a better, you know, overall record than we did. But the world changed in 1992. And so they had to use what we did, and that is combination of sort of, you know, people-related things and also technology-related. So there's something called MPCNA, Materials Protection Control and Accounting. And we work with the Russians very, very closely to have them look at what we were doing and then trying to implement that kind of a system. I started that program, Charlie Curtis, who was Undersecretary of the Department of Energy at that time, in April of 1994, when the government program wasn't getting anywhere because the Russians said, that's too sensitive. We take care of our own nuclear materials. We don't need you guys. But the Russian scientists said, hey, look, we've got a problem. So Charlie Curtis gave me $2 million at Los Alamos to go and start working on that in 1994. When the Russians completed and essentially ended that program in December of 2014, it had spent about $4 billion. And it was immense as to what was actually done. Here I am in my younger years with Belugin and Ilkayev from Vinyev, with Avroin from Menetiev, and with one of my favorite Russians, Nikolai Nikolaevich, he calls himself Nick Ponomaryov Stepnoy at Kurchatov Institute. We signed the first contracts and we went from there. And the reason this was so important is that it's just so difficult to keep those nuclear materials secure and safeguarded. And that's the reason. There's so much of it. It's in all kinds of places. It's in many different forms. It's not like gold bullion that you put into Fort Knox. These things are industrial materials. And so you have to have a system and not just guards and guns. We work with them. We started this program. I sent one of my guys, Mark Mullen, to the Department of Energy to head up this effort. He was the chief technical advisor. Here, just all the places in the Soviet Union. We started out with their atomic energy complex, the military complex, nuclear complex, and then the military complex itself, including the nuclear navy, strategic rocket forces, 12 GUMO. And this book has remarkable stories in there from both the Americans and the Russians as to what was actually done. In today's world that we live in, you know, difficulties we have with us, you can't believe that this was actually done, but it was done. The most sort of incredible story was actually at Semipalatinsk. I'll take a few more minutes. I'll just give you the short version again. I wrote a piece on Semipalatinsk, but the best one in here on Semipalatinsk, the one by my Russian colleague who worked with us on this. And the issue was, when I finished directorship at Los Alamos in November of 1997, I started to pay more attention yet and spend more time on the issue of nuclear materials. And so I kind of thought, where could all the nuclear materials, where could all the problems be around the world, and particularly, you know, former Soviet Union related? And so one of the places I thought was the test site. You know, it's now in the country of Kazakhstan. It doesn't belong to the Russians anymore. And if the Nevada test site would belong to a different country tomorrow, or be a different country, I'd be worried, really worried, because we left stuff at that test site that we're depending on it being the United States. So I went to Russia, to Vinnytsev, to Vinnytsev, and I said, what did you guys leave behind? They said, we're not going back. It doesn't matter, we're not going back. They just want to hit us up for environmental damage. We're not going back to Semipalatinsk ever. So here's the more or less the history. You know, lots of nuclear tests conducted at the test site, both in the atmosphere. Of course, that stuff's gone. You know, it's blown all over everywhere. But then underground, just a simple question, for example, and I asked the guy at Vinnytsev, Boris Litvinov, I said, hey, Boris, did all of your bombs work? You know, when you put them in the tunnel, when you turned the switch, they blew up. He said, well, of course not. I said, well, what's left down there? He said, it's in the tunnels. I said, well, that's not your country anymore. You know, what are you going to do about that? And then particularly, we had done a number of tests. I showed you that moratorium, 58 to 61. We had a number of tests where we were not allowed to do nuclear explosions. But we did very, very low yield experiments. We did some of those at Nevada, and we did some of those at Los Alamos on our 43 square miles. When I became director, I found out for the first time that I owned a bunch of plutonium that's down hole out in one of our mesas. I never knew that. So I said, they got to have the same thing out there. So I asked them about that. They said, oh, no, we didn't do any of that. So at any rate, it turns out we also met up with Kazakhs because they were part of this ISTC, International Science Technology Center program, the State Department ran. Kazakhs worked with us, and Kairat Kadyazhanov, that I've already shown you, came to visit in January of 1998. And so we talked about Semipalatinsk, and I said, hey, Kairat, are you worried about Semipalatinsk? You know, it's your country now. And he said, they don't tell us anything. You know, but he said, you know, secure, the Russian soldiers are gone. You know, we have some soldiers, but it's a very small force. They're gone. And they don't tell us anything. And besides, he said, there are a whole bunch of nomads out there and they're stealing copper cables. And I said, oh my God. So I went out. So he invited me out, as you can see here, 19th of April, 1998. This is their test site. That's the main guard gate to the test site now. And then these copper cable thieves, which I thought would be guys on camelback, you know, pulling on copper cables. What we saw instead was this: trenches, hundreds of kilometers of trenches dug with industrial equipment. Copper cable pulled out, and what I was concerned about, what's at the end of some of those copper cables? I took those photos back to Rady Elkayev at Vinyev later that year, and I said, Rady, take a look at this. He said, I'll be back to you next morning. He called Moscow. We started a program in 1998 that was super secret until about 2012, where we worked with the Russians and the Kazakhs. The Russians came back with us. The Kazakhs helped us. We worked together, and we tried to deal with this program. Some of it, it turns out they did the same sort of test that I just mentioned we had done at Los Alamos. They also, I told you, they love to blow things up. We would do plutonium tests in a glove box. They took a little piece of plutonium, put explosive behind it, put it down a couple of meters, and banged it with the explosive to measure its response. I mean, perfectly reasonable thing to do. And then they left it there. You know, it turns out plutonium in the environment, plutonium doesn't go anywhere, essentially. So they weren't worried about environmental problems. And then they were not worried about security problems. It's Soviet Union, but it wasn't anymore. So here's a field where they did, you know, dozens of these experiments and left the plutonium in the ground. And then we thought about, we worked together, you know, should we dig it out? Should we send it back to Russia? What do? We eventually had them put, and the Kazakhs did the work, put a sarcophagus around it. And now we have drones that survey the area, and the whole, actually not only drones, but even seismic sensors, where you can actually tell whether somebody's walking out around. And then we did this, and it took a long time. It took more than a dozen years, because just when we thought we were done, we said, okay, are we finished? They said, well, no, there's actually, you know, these other things we did. And just one after another, we went through these. Human dimension. So I asked, I started this effort and asked my colleague, Phil Hemberger, to run it from Los Alamos standpoint. So this was eventually done through DTRA, because I took it from the Department of Energy, you know, which was funding our activities, to DTRA, because they had the big bucks, and they spent $150 million on this program, and then we just became the scientific advisors, and particularly the interlocutors with the Russians. And here's Yuri Stiachkin. He's the guy who did many of those physics experiments out there. And so at this point, the three of us, we will take Yuri Stiachkin and his colleagues out to dinner. But this again is so Russian. And Yuri said, you know, I don't really want to go to a restaurant. You know, why don't we just get some chleb, some piva, you know, and we'll bring it back to the hotel room and get some salami, and we'll just eat and talk here. Again, look at those faces. You know, that's the human dimension. I mean, that's the bond that allowed us to take care of this. Unfortunately, Yuri Stiachkin died, but his colleague, who we worked with, Viktor Stepanyuk, wrote this. So eventually, you know, 26 sites, and think we took care of about 100 kilograms. Again, North Korea, 20 to 40 is 100 kilograms out there in the steppes of Kazakhstan, and you know where Kazakhstan is close to. So you talk about issue. Last night, a couple of people asked me about nuclear terrorism. Aren't you concerned about nuclear terrorism? That's what got me to go to Semipalatinsk, because the terrorists can't build a nuclear reactor without that being spotted. The terrorists at this point, they can't do the uranium enrichment, but they can steal it or try to buy it. And that's what we were worried about, and the Russians, Kazakhs, and we worked hand in hand. The human dimension, here's Rady Elkayev on the right, I'm on the left, on Nazarbayev's horses, it turns out. And I, of course, I went to Kazakhstan, and I met Bill's people over in Kazakhstan, you know, they were there. So the personal relationships matter. Then sometimes, you know, I even became an honorary Kazakh, you know, with my two Kazakh buddy there, to make sure that we work the problems from the national security standpoint. So let me, let's take a 10-minute break now. I'll come back and finish that up. And then the third module is essentially trying to get us in today's environment as to what do we do now. So let's take 10 till 20 after.